the Honorable Justices of the Supreme Court of the State of Alaska.
This is the time set for oral argument in Weatherhorn versus Alaska Psychiatric Institute. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
You may proceed, Mr. Gottstein.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the Court. I'm Jim Gottstein, representing Rosalind Weatherhorn, the appellant in this case. This appeal is mostly, the reason why we're here is what I consider a major policy issue, which is to as an attempt to address the systemic ineffective assistance of counsel in AS 4730 involuntary commitment and involuntary medication proceedings. There are also a couple, you know, some strictly legal issues, such as whether Civil Rule 82 applies to these proceedings, and some other issues such as enhanced fees under Civil Rule 82 and sanctions under Civil Rules 11 and 95A. But from my perspective, it's this pervasive abuse of what I consider this state of Alaska's court system in a denial of people's fundamental constitutional rights and statutory rights, for that matter, as a matter of course in these type of proceedings that brings us here. And in order to address this issue, we're seeking a ruling that prevailing psychiatric respondents in AS 4730, involuntary commitment and involuntary medication proceedings, will receive full reasonable attorney's fees. And the reason for that is to, is an attempt to encourage the private bar to take these cases and take them seriously. The court, just about a month ago, decided Weatherhorn 1, where we had sought to establish criteria for effective assistance of counsel, and suggested that if relief was granted there, might not be as important here. And the court found or held that a direct appeal was not the proper way to address ineffective assistance of counsel. And I understand the reasons for that. But that really leaves this question of what's happening here in, you know, under the aegis of the Alaska court system to people being subject to these proceedings. So that's really a policy question. I think before we get to that, the question is, or in order to get to that, I should say, is the question is, does Civil Rule 82 apply to these proceedings? The probate rules are not entirely clear on that. However, in Crittell versus Bingo, this court held that Civil Rule 82 did apply to probate matters. Now, these proceedings are not technically probate matters, but they have been assigned to the probate court, and there are certain things in the probate rules that apply to them. So certainly they've been considered under the probate rules. And the probate rules basically apply, or say that the civil rules apply, unless they're inconsistent, essentially, with the purposes of the proceedings. Now, the state argues that under the Cooper case, which was a child in need of aid case, that where this court held that Civil Rule 82 does not apply there because of the nature of those proceedings, that should be applied here as well. And I would suggest that there are a couple of things that are really important as to why that ruling should not apply in these cases. First off, the child in need of aid rules have a list of civil rules that apply, and it skips over Civil Rule 82, suggesting a deliberate a deletion of Civil Rule 82 from those proceedings. Now, there's no comparable rule under the the more generalized probate rules, so you don't really have that assumption. I think Cooper was also decided under former rules. The other one is that in Cooper, the court talked about I think you would call it the benevolent nature of those proceedings, that it would be inappropriate to chill the state's efforts to protect children through the award of an attorney's fee against the state when it lost. I think that, first off, in the case this court decided last June, in Myers, the court implicitly rejected that idea in another context where it recognized that the hospital has other objectives or interests that it oftentimes will find paramount to therapeutic interests in seeking forced drugging. So I think that's kind of an implicit rejection of that. So that's basically the Rule 82 argument. The other issue in this case is whether Ms. Weatherhorn was the prevailing party. And what it seems to me is that there really ought to be a bright line rule that if the hospital files a petition and then after being challenged on it abandons that petition, that it ought to just be considered that the respondent was the prevailing party. And I think this case really illustrates why that should be so, because here the hospital has the power really to kind of just insert into the record its version of what happened. And in this case, which is why we got into these other issues, is I was there. And, the court can't really take that perhaps, but I was there. I know that that's why the case was dismissed. And for the state then to say, whatever it was, 3 days earlier, which they would have, if I hadn't been there, the petition almost certainly would have been granted because that was the schedule for it. Then to say that they just released her just by happenstance after they'd held her over 30 days and had filed a petition on her, really, I think, strains credulity. My way of thinking is that the state argues, well, she just didn't meet commitment criteria and therefore she was released. And I agree with that. But the question is really why she was held so long when she didn't meet commitment criteria, because it's almost certain that she really didn't meet commitment criteria prior to that. And when they were faced with actually having to be put to the test on meeting commitment criteria and forced drugging criteria, that they folded their camp. So that's that one. On the civil rule, we also sought Civil Rule 11 and 95A sanctions for what I think are violations of Civil Rule 11. The state at the trial court asserted or represented Cooper to say that the court could only award fees if there was a statute. And what Cooper says, and what is clear, is that the court can award fees if there's a statute or a court rule. And then in the briefing here, it kind of pretends like it had done that below, but it hadn't. And perhaps that's within the bounds of permissible misrepresentation of a case or not. That's up to the court. I was obviously offended by it and think it ought to be addressed. And really the same issue with this issue of the prevailing party, which from my perspective, you had lawyers in the case that really weren't there who came up with this rationale when it really wasn't, had no basis in fact. And then the question is whether or not that should be, whether that's a violation of Civil Rule 11. So that's roughly going down through the legal issues in the case. I don't really have to take all of my time here unless there are any other questions.
I'm curious about the prevailing party issue a little bit, and what factual showing, if any, was made to convince the Superior Court that your client really was the prevailing party? In other words, that the dismissal was not simply a voluntary act, but it was, in effect, an inevitable result of seeing the light, so to speak, or being convinced that your client was correct.
Well, Your Honor, I suggested to the Superior Court, if there was any question about that, there should be a hearing on that. And the court didn't take that up. And then, but I also presented some billing records and affirmative representation of what we had done that caused the state to, or the hospital to, dismiss the petition. So it just seemed like if there was really any question over the factual part of it, it should have been, that factual issue should have been addressed.
Can I ask you, in distinguishing Cooper, you mentioned child in need of aid rule 1E that lists civil rules that are applicable and doesn't include Rule 82. But that, I assume that subsection wasn't in effect at the time that Cooper was decided, because it's not mentioned in the Cooper opinion. Is that your understanding?
Yes, my understanding was decided under the prior rules.
Right, and so given that that rule was not present when Cooper was decided, it seems like Cooper is a pretty close analogy, although that was a child in need of aid proceeding. This type of proceeding could very well be called an adult in need of aid proceeding, couldn't it?
I think that there's some logic to that, frankly. I think, though, that a couple of things. One is in promulgating the rules, the same scheme could have been promulgated to make that more clear. And the other is, as I mentioned, which I think this court in Myers really implicitly addressed, is that the court has recognized that whereas in the child in need of aid provisions, there's really no question about the true benevolent nature of those, of what's going on, that's really not necessarily true in these cases. So those would be the reasons why I would think, I would suggest that the opposite result should.
I read with interest your argument in that context, though. I mean, you're arguing that in Myers we talked about different reasons for medicating patients, not some kind of that might be for convenience or just to keep things more controlled within the institution. But what would the ulterior motive for committing a person involuntarily be?
Well, I think that the court did discuss that in terms of forced drugging, and that was in this case as well. I think that, to answer that question, one can really get into the whole idea to the extent at which the involuntary commitment process is used, and then I think the court discussed it a little bit in Myers, is used to lock up people that are acting in ways that other people don't like, bothering people that maybe doesn't rise to something that would involve criminal behavior or those sorts of things. And so I don't think we really have a record on that, but it's something that is certainly well discussed in the literature as one of the ways that the involuntary commitment regimes are used around the country.
Thank you. Ms. Russo?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Elizabeth Russo, and I am representing Alaska Psychiatric Institute in this proceeding today. Contrary to all the issues that Ms. Weatherhorn's attorney has tried to bring before the court, the question before the court today is a simple one. Should attorney's fees be awarded to Ms. Weatherhorn? And the answer is equally simple. No. This is for two reasons. First and foremost, it's against public policy to award attorney's fees to respondents in such cases. And secondly, even if it weren't against public policy, Ms. Weatherhorn is simply not the prevailing party in this case. Now, if we step back from the facts of this particular case and look at the larger picture as to whether or not attorney's fees are even applicable to the private attorneys who represent respondents in civil commitments, we can see that to have such a rule, it's not practical, and it is against public policy. Civil commitments are inherently different than typical civil proceedings. You just can't go into looking at a civil commitment thinking it's the same thing. It's not whether or not one party's been wronged by another. It's whether or not the person who is the respondent in the proceeding is at such a risk of harm to either themselves or to others that the state has to take action to protect them, to protect others, and help them get better. Now, the vast majority of individuals who are respondents in civil commitments do recover. So Ms. Weatherhorn's logic would ultimately hold the state liable for attorney's fees in every single civil commitment that takes place.
Can you direct us to information as to whether the vast majority of such respondents are represented by a publicly appointed counsel or private counsel?
I don't know if I think it was addressed in the briefing below. I don't know if there's an actual factual point where it is. It's in the statutes that the respondents are appointed counsel. 4739.905B is where they discuss the payment of the appointed counsel.
Right, but I was wondering whether that's the usual thing or not.
It is in my practice at API, but I don't know if it's ever been documented anywhere. Mm-hmm. Now, to place the state at risk of having to pay attorney's fees to every respondent in these cases is a horribly high burden when the state is merely exercising a legitimate state interest. The court has recognized that there is a legitimate state interest in both the Myers and Weatherhorn decisions. This state does have a legitimate reason to civilly commit certain individuals on certain occasions. And additionally, because there is this legitimate interest and a legitimate concern, many people do wind up being committed. If Ms. Weatherhorn prevails on this issue, then those patients are also liable for attorney's fees if they are committed. Weatherhorn argued in the briefing.
Mr. Gutstein's response to that argument in his reply, I thought, was that they already are being charged $1,000 a day to stay at API against their will, and that the $60 of attorney's fees for an hour of 30% of an hour of attorney time would be de minimis in light of the fact that they're already being charged huge amounts despite the fact that they didn't want to be there.
Right, and the response to that is that cost of hospitalization is a completely different issue as to whether or not there's a cost of attorney's fees. And if it's a de minimis amount in the great percentage, I mean, many of these people, well, I can't make presumptions, but I would say that to still have somebody liable for an additional charge, I mean, to just tack it on because it's something, you know, little compared to everything else, that's not exactly a...
Does API regularly charge involuntarily committed patients $1,000 a day?
I don't know that, Your Honor. I could look it up for you, but I don't know that off the top of my head. So to hold somebody liable for attorney's fees when the state's trying to protect them just doesn't make sense. And her reliance on Crittle as the justification for attorney's fees and civil commitments is similarly misplaced. Weatherhorn ignores the differences between that case and civil commitments. She completely avoids the last sentence of Probate Rule 1E, that the civil rules do apply to probate proceedings, unless, quote, such a procedure may not be inconsistent with these rules and may not unduly delay or otherwise interfere with the unique character and purpose of probate proceedings, unquote. That's the reason why Crittle is ultimately distinguishable, because civil commitments are unique from typical civil proceedings. Their very nature is unique. The state is exercising parental power in an order to protect certain vulnerable individuals. This is similar to the very nature by which child in need of aid proceedings are unique. There, too, the state is protecting vulnerable individuals. Thus, the analogy to Cooper is not as misplaced as Weatherhorn suggests. An award of attorney's fees to the losing party in a civil commitment is inconsistent with the goal of the proceeding, which is to protect society from persons who are dangerous to others and to protect persons who are dangerous to themselves. In addition, with China proceedings, you have hearings often throughout the life of the case. The actual process, comparatively to a civil commitment, is also fluid. Very few people who do still meet commitment criteria on day 29 of their commitment are sufficiently recovered on day 30 to be discharged. The timelines for reviews that are in the statutes are somewhat arbitrary, but a person is always entitled to a review hearing if they feel that they no longer meet the commitment criteria during their time of commitment. So how would we be able to judge when to mark a cutoff for attorney's fees? Now, if we look at the facts of this case, it's clear that Ms. Weatherhorn is not the prevailing party. She did not prevail at the 30-day hearing, but she recovered from her grave disability and was discharged from API before there could even be a 90-day hearing. Thus, there's no basis to award her attorney's fees. Prior to the hospital filing the 90-day commitment petition, Ms. Weatherhorn chose to retain private counsel and substitute him for the public defender agency who had been appointed to represent her prior to that. API filed the 90-day petition, and Ms. Weatherhorn's attorney filed a notice that she was electing to have a jury trial, which is her right. 4 days later, and before a jury trial could be held, she had recovered, and she was discharged. Her discharge was because her doctors no longer felt she met commitment criteria, not because API was intimidated by her attorney or the like. This is important because she is not moving only for regular 82 fees, but also for enhanced fees based on the work her attorney did. This is a situation where everyone won.
To decide the prevailing party issue, did the trial court have to consider whether API allegedly mooted the dispute by discharging her in order to avoid the legal dispute?
And
did the court decide that issue?
The court decided that Ms. Weatherhorn was not the prevailing party, and she did bring up those exact arguments in the pleadings to the trial court. Now, just because an individual is committed, it doesn't mean that they're going to remain committed for the rest of their lives. Most people's condition improves so that they will be discharged back home. Ultimately, Weatherhorn became better herself. API is not going to discharge patients who they feel still meet the commitment criteria, but by the same token, API is not going to, it's not a jail. It's not going to release individuals if they feel that they are still in need of recovery, but it's a psychiatric hospital. The goal is to treat individuals and help them live full and productive lives outside of its four walls. As stated earlier, her discharge does not make her the prevailing party, because by that logic, everyone who is civilly committed to API would be the prevailing party at some time. I would just rely on the arguments made in briefing as to why Rule 95 fees are similarly inappropriate in this case. I believe it's a reasonable disagreement between the parties. The trial court upheld API's position below. In summary, similarly to China cases, Rule 82 fees simply do not apply to civil commitments. It's against public policy. And even if they did, Ms. Weatherhorn was simply not the prevailing party at any stage. Thank you. Do you have any further questions?
Apparently not. Thank you, Ms. Russo. Mr. Gottstein, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I thought I'd start out by addressing a couple of questions that the court asked. And one, Justice Matthews, you asked whether or not the vast majority of psychiatric respondents have appointed counsel. I'm very familiar with the Anchorage situation, less outside of Anchorage. But the vast majority, I think, of involuntary commitment and medication proceedings are in Anchorage. I think there's some in, I think, Juneau and some in Fairbanks and maybe even some in Kodiak. But most of them are here. And it's not really the vast majority. They're appointed automatically. And in fact, when I first started getting into the cases, the probate court didn't even really know what to do with me, and I wouldn't get served with papers and things like that. So it's automatic that they get appointed. And actually, I think that's a problem because there's no inquiry as to people who might actually be able to pay for an attorney. Sometimes these petitions get filed an hour before the hearing, and the public defender shows up, and from my perspective, put on no defense. And this is for people, some people might even be able to afford an attorney. I think that addresses that question. And then, Chief Justice Faber, you asked if patients are regularly charged, and they are regularly charged. I think that's automatic as well. Collection is not very good because most of these people are indigent on welfare, disability, and all that, or at least they end up that way after a while. So they are charged as a matter of course. In fact, I think it's a regulatory requirement. I was kind of so offended by that, I checked into the constitutionality of it, and I found that I couldn't find a single case that didn't find that it was unconstitutional. But they are charged.
You couldn't find a single case that didn't find that it
no,
was?
No, that found that it was unconstitutional. All the cases find that it's constitutional to charge people who for services that they don't want under these circumstances. I think that the question of probate rule 1E, an issue of the civil rules applying if they're not inconsistent with the purposes, it calls for answer by this court in consideration of the situation here and the arguments made by both parties. I don't think that it really addresses the situation one way or the other than to say again that the child in need of aid rule specifically skips over it for whatever worth that is, and then the other arguments on that. I think that really if Justice Eastall, you asked whether or not the trial court decided that, the factual issue of the prevailing party, and Ms. Russo said, well, we made those arguments and the judge ruled against us. But really all the judge said was one sentence, not the prevailing party, and no discussion at all as to why that was so. And I think that's maybe a reasonable segue into what will be my last point, which is I'm not saying that every patient that's discharged should be considered a prevailing party, but if the hospital files a petition on someone and then abandons that petition in the face of a challenge, that makes a person a prevailing party. So unless there are other questions, that's what I have.
Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel. We'll take this matter under advisement. We stand in recess until 1:30.